Welcome to Discover Indie Film. I've got Jonathan Latona right here in person. Hey, Jonathan.
Hey, how's it going?
All right. He is here. We've finally got a feature filmmaker in for a while. Yeah, I haven't seen one for a minute. And Jonathan, his film Doug, which played at Filmvasion LA in 2020, took home the Audience Award for Best Feature. You want to name how many hats you had? Writer, director, producer,
everything.
Cinematographer. Absolutely everything.
Everything but sound, yeah.
Everything but sound. And he took home Best Cinematography.
Yes.
Which is rad. And well deserved, because man, that film looks good. And also your lead actor got Best Lead Actor, and I think we all know that the director has something to do with the performances on screen. So
I would hope so. There wasn't really much you could do for Doug, though. He pretty much knew what he was doing all along, so.
He did own that. I mean, the film's actually, his name is Doug.
Yeah.
And he plays Doug, so yeah, he owned that role.
Pretty much, yeah. No, it's, yeah. He surprised me, so.
Yeah. So this is one of those podcasts I'm not going to start off, but here I do it subtly. I'm not going to start off telling people to go watch the TV series on Amazon Prime Video called Discover Indie Film, because Jonathan's film is a feature, so it's not in there. We haven't added features to that, although I was going to tell him, hey, man, if people who self-release sometimes, I think, like, why not have a series of features on Discover Indie Film? But anyway.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I'm just going to let Jonathan jump right in, since we don't have to talk about all that stuff. At the end of this conversation, we'll talk about all the websites and social media handles you should know for the shit I do and the shit Jonathan does. I'm making it clear, we can curse all we want.
Oh, it's total shit.
Total. All right, so go ahead. I warned Jonathan the first question was going to be, how did you end up a filmmaker? Like, what inspired you? What were your early starts of this?
Oh, so we're going back in time.
Yeah, go back. Go back to, okay. What inspired you to get into it? Or what was the first, first stuff you played with? Did you start as a kid? Did you get interested in school?
I don't know. I got to think about it for a second. Because, I remember my grandfather having an old VHS tape camcorder where you actually had to put the part of the tape into the cassette and put the cassette in the camera and then actually start recording.
Yeah, and it was a massive suitcase size thing.
It was like the size of a throw pillow or a suitcase, yeah. And then they just got increasingly smaller over time. But his was like one of the old school ones where like the eyepiece came out and extended like to your eye, actually extended to your eye, and then had all that. And that's when I learned what a cut was, when I actually pressed record and stopped for the first time, then watched on TV. And I said, oh, that's what they do.
Right, so you did, so you were playing with it, and you almost accidentally edited it in camera, and then when you watched it play back, you saw, I edited it in camera just now.
Yeah, and I didn't know what that meant until, later.
because who wouldn't?
Maybe a decade or so later.
Well, how old were you for this?
I don't remember.
That's under 10?
Maybe.
Elementary school-ish?
Eight? I don't really remember. Yes,
but so early that you weren't, it wasn't like you were a kid who was trying to replicate what you saw on TV.
I didn't know anything yet.
Yeah.
I just knew what a cut was and just knew what they did. But later on in life, then, maybe I want to say a handful of years later, my father left the country, and that's another story in of itself. And then I kind of pretty much just threw myself into middle school, high school age, because I don't remember a large part of my childhood, believe it or not. And then finally, when I was in high school, it was freshman year of high school, I started going to drama clubs and things like that. And then by the end of my first semester, freshman year, it was that kind of crossroad, fork in the road thing. And I decided to take acting a little more seriously. And so I joined drama class. I joined another acting class outside of school that I started going to, not knowing that that's what people do, you know, not knowing that that's what people in other, cause I mean, this is in South Florida during like the late 90s, early 2000s, like Columbine just happened, you know, and then all of a sudden it's like high school. And then, you know, it's like 2004 high school was my freshman year. And then later on, I just kind of like just, took it more and more seriously. And I tried to get pushed into like a direction of like, oh yeah, you should actually focus more on your academics, because I just had the worst time in school, test wise and everything like that. And I would just write all the time. I would overwrite my essays. I would overwrite papers. I would piss teachers off all the time. And then finally, you know, I decided to, quit drama program because they were, you know, terrible people.
The people in the drama program.
The drama program who it was run by.
Right, and your school.
And the school and the people who were affiliated with the drama program inside the school were just terrible people all around.
Right. Not just staff, but the kids. Like, it was just a... It was only run by a shitty clique.
It was, a terrible clique. It was run by one woman who was just a, you know, beast of a ghastly woman. And everyone else, you know, kind of just like, you know, it was almost as if, you know, how high school plays politics and things like that. So literally that's what it was. And lo and behold, you know, things got pretty dirty and pretty messy. And then so my mom just was like kind of like trying to wean me out of it. So much so where I had to pretty much drop out of everything. And yeah, it was just a terrible experience all around. It was supposed to be positive, but it wasn't. And anyone else would have basically just quit and probably, you know, not have come to LA to do their thing. But like when I had come here and tried to meet up with some of the kids who actually had been in that same program and been out here, none of them have ever to this day have never contacted. So I'm just like, fuck them. You know, they're terrible people. So I'll throw them under a bus. I won't say names, but I'll throw
them under a bus. For sure. You haven't named the school or anything.
It's pretty obvious where, when you get to know me, but yeah, no.
But what's really kind of fascinating there is instead of, So the standard story you hear is, oh, there was this incredibly inspiring drama teacher that brought out your desire to perform. But you have a desire. First, you played with the camera. Mm-hmm. Then you got into performance through mm-hmm. school plays and shit. Mm-hmm. And then you had such a crappy teacher that you stepped away.
Yeah.
But you didn't lose the love. Like that crappy program didn't make you just flip off acting entirely.
Right. I knew that this is what I wanted to do. I just was never playing with the right people.
And were you more interested in acting then than the writing and the shooting, or?
No, I think, well, yeah, kind of, sort of, a little bit of both. But like, you know, I just really wanted to learn about the whole thing, and no one would really, you know, be willing to teach it in a enthusiastic way. And I'd met kids who'd had great experiences, went on to great schools. I didn't. And I've always had a chip on my shoulder about it. You know?
So did you come right out to LA, or did you do some school in between?
No. I did. Then my mom came up with the brilliant idea of going to North Carolina. And it was like one of those places that she'd always wanted to go to. But she had chosen...
like pick up and move.
Yeah. Like leave. Like when I was like 18. She says, I'm going with or without you. And I was like, oh, okay. Because the idea was get into a state school
right. In
Florida. Like go to Florida State or go somewhere else. Be with the same swine people, but like actually get shit done. You know, be with a different group of Floridian kids, whatever. You know what
I
mean?
Yeah, I mean, you were probably one good teacher away from having a good program,
oh,
right?
Because yeah,
it
for
all
sure.
filters down.
Well, this is where, yeah, so this is where it gets really interesting.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So we go to, you know, my mom is like, let's go to Asheville. I say, you know, no, not Asheville. Let's, you know, maybe. And then she's like, okay, I'll do some more research. And then she found this one place called Wilmington, North Carolina, right off the coast, 90 minutes north of Myrtle Beach. So I was like, yeah, I was like, let's go there because, you know, they were in the middle of doing shows. They were in the middle of actually shooting things, you know? And so I thought it would be like a smaller version of Los Angeles. And it really wasn't that until like maybe a few years later. But I'd got in at a good time. And at the time thinking about it, you know, I just don't know the town. I don't know the area. It's very tiny. I'm trying to get acclimated to it. You know, I'm only 18 at the time when I first moved there. And so I didn't know anything. My mom was trying to psych me up to move out of the house at some point. And, you know, I was trying to do all of that. And, you know, I got a job, you know, typical teenage, like 18, 19, 20, you know, experience. And things were not working out for me for a few years there. And
yeah, because changing states meant you couldn't like apply to like a public college in North Carolina and qualify resident.
I wasn't even getting into the Florida colleges, so right. I had to go to the community college route. And so, you know, at the time, my mom was kind of freaked out because she went that route and she didn't have a good time. And so the first thing we did was, you know, enroll me in this wonderful school called Cape Fear Community College. And she was like, oh, no, it's a great school. You'll love it. It's called Cape Fear. It's based off, you know, I'm like, yeah, I thinking mean, the movie.
Yeah, the movie. That's the movie where the woman got her face bit off.
Yeah, exactly. I'm thinking the movie. I'm like, but it's actually Cape Fear because of the river. Because yeah. There's a Cape Fear River that runs through the city and everything. And the school is like right there. Like, no
right,
shit.
Like, beautiful and
downtown.
And by a river.
It's fucking great. You got walking distance to everything, you know? And so we moved, we got there, and, you know, started school and immediately just hated it.
Because it was new and different or it wasn't a good fit?
I wasn't in film school yet. You had to do the first semester bullshit, you know?
Was prerequisite, right?
Prerequisites to everything. So my first year at Cape Fear was shot. I had to take all my prerequisite courses before I could take the actual.
Right. The stuff you don't want to learn, you got to just suffer for a year while you're probably trying to get a job and stuff, part-time.
Yeah.
I remember. Like, that's just not a fun year.
Oh, yeah. I remember being completely miserable when the first JJ.
And you just moved, so it's not like you got a group of friends.
Just moved. And I remember being completely miserable, literally going for walks, trying to entertain myself. I mean, at the time, I wasn't living downtown. I was living in another county over. So the town I was living in wasn't really developed yet, and it was getting developed. And so I would literally have to walk in circles every maybe hour, maybe top of the hour, just to entertain myself, listening to, you know, whatever I listened to at the time. I think it was just like an amalgamation of like things I listen to now, like, you know, 80s rock. Things that, you know.
And
you know,
then, the music we love at 18 pretty much lasts for about 30 to 60 years.
Hopefully, right?
Yeah.
But it wasn't anything really contemporary. You know, I didn't. And then walking around, and then finally saying to myself, man, this fucking sucks. You know, like I'd just seen J.J. Abrams' Star Trek, and I was like, why the fuck am I, you know. Like, that was the direction everything was going in at the time, and you know, I was just kind of, like, just not really in a good spot until a year or so later when I could start taking the classes that I wanted to take. And then it was just, like, I had to take a summer course within the first year just to catch up. And then finally, you know, but I got a good feel of the town at this point, you know. So by the time it was my second year, I was already a year behind, but I was finally learning at my own pace. I was learning with the people that I wanted to learn with. And more importantly, I was finally taking film courses with a guy named David Kreutzer. And he was the guy who's like, you know, huge inspiration.
Worked for you, resonated.
Yeah.
The kind of teacher you needed.
Yes. Oh, yeah. No, he was literally like one of a kind. I never met anybody quite like this guy before. You know, just like, you know, interesting dude. He now teaches at University of Georgia.
Actually. Oh, his abilities got recognized.
He was the kind of dude who first day he was like, you know, Dead Poets Society shit.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like tear it out. You know?
No, I mean, this guy was critical for you.
Oh, yeah, big
yeah.
time.
Okay, yeah, big time. This is one of those human beings turning around your life kind of things.
Oh, yeah, no, he was the kind of dude who was like, you know, I mean, it's funny that like
and you're now, like 19 like, at that point probably, the second year?
I was turning 20.
Turning 20?
Yeah, I was turning 20.
Which, so, at the time, you felt old. But looking back, it's like, oh, wow, 20 is
oh, yeah, no,
20.
No, no.
20 is still a baby.
The first thing he told us to do was buy this one book, which was about, I honestly don't remember the name of it, but everything that I do now was in that book. Everything, you know, the switch cuts, the pan cuts, the, make it look like one shot cuts, like everything was in that, I forgot what it's called. I think I still have it somewhere, but I literally don't remember the name of it.
Interesting.
It's like garage filmmaking or some shit. And then
there
was
a super influential book. It was like got more influential because Kevin Smith had read it.
Oh, yeah, sure.
But the feature films for used car prices or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
But it's not that one.
My favorite was Rebel Without a Crew. That was my favorite. And, you know, that was like one book that I had read a few times before actually starting the real film school experience. And then, you know,
right. So you were actually very enthusiastic about film.
Oh, big time. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, more so than like,
and you weren't just like dying to act. You were dying to be a filmmaker at that point.
I had given up acting at that point.
Yeah.
I had given up acting, when I quit drama actually. And,
right. And there was no desire to jump back into that. You were completely on the other side in your mind. You just transitioned to the other side of the camera.
Yeah. Cause I had read all the acting books. I read every fucking acting book, and they all confused the fucking shit out of me. Like, literally, like, they all confused the living shit out of me. The one that made the most sense, to me anyway, sorry, I'm fucking getting emotional.
No, which I think is actually great.
It's the ratings! No, I'm kidding. No, you can cut that out. But, but the one, the Stanislavski books were the ones that really resonated the most. And, those were the ones I think that I was just like all in on and read all the ones. But Uta Hagen, Meisner, I got into a fight with an acting coach in college because he was trying to teach me Meisner and I did not have the mental capacity at the time to understand it. How anybody teaches Meisner to children, I guess that makes sense, but to, like, there's something that happens when people get older. There's some sort of, like, trigger goes off where they don't really comprehend situations like children or older adults do. And so, you know, he was like, oh, repetition. I was just like, what the fuck are you fucking talking about? You know, this doesn't make any sense to me. I don't get it because what?
Yeah. Know? I mean, I'm no expert on the acting things, but yeah, Meisner, I know is now. Highly emotionally sophisticated, right? It's like embodying a character.
And no, it's more of just, you know, talking and listening, I feel like, you know, and I get it now because, you know, just like, having worked on my own projects, having worked on, you know, other projects and even being background and everything, like, you know, it's tough because you have to literally just be in that zone with that person. And I think those exercises where he, you know, they say, oh, your eyes are blue, whatever the fuck. And then you change it as it goes along, but you change it based on how the person hears it. You know, that to me is interesting. And we did a lot of that with Doug too. I, you know, a lot of just going back and forth, trying new things and, you know, seeing what worked. But, a lot of it, you know, I did not understand it at 21, you know, and I needed time, you know? So I just was like, okay, acting is just there, but I want to focus more on producing and making stuff because I knew that that's what the future was for me. And I knew that that was the direction I was going in. So,
and by the way, I totally so swept up in the story when you felt that was for you. I mean, was it also because you were a bit of a film fan? Like, were you a cinephile?
Oh, of course.
Were you like renting movies all the time? Like you were into the medium.
That period of time when I was done with the drama program, I was still in high school, but I had nothing going on. So movies and research and reading was all that I had.
Right.
And I didn't, the first time I bought a film camera was maybe like my senior year gift or whatever. And, you know, that was like a mini DV, but everything was like the small mini DVs. And then the first thing I did when I was in Wilmington was, I started filming bands.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
So there was a music scene there.
There was a big music scene that was just, it was blooming. It wasn't really like, it was blossoming into something and then it died immediately. But I was there to capture like at least the blossoming end. And then now it's like big again, but it's only a matter of time before it dies again. I'm guaranteeing that just because of the way things work over there. And, you know, people are just, you know, they'll get fucking swept up.
Well, it's not a big population.
It's getting big now, but it's not a big place.
To keep a music scene going when you're like less than a million people or whatever, like, I don't see how.
During the years of 2009 and 2012, I think I'd maybe gone to 300, maybe 500 different shows that were just bands like that I was either filming or that I was a part of or that I was just spectating or I was just really like at and I didn't know what it was, you know, that kind of stuff.
So, right, like at small clubs and just.
It was one of those things where it was just like all around kind of just like just different types of clubs like.
But music clubs, like where you go see live music when you're in your 20s.
There was one music club.
You can finally drink.
One music club, everything else was a bar.
Right.
You know, kind of vibe. And then, you know, there would be big bars and then it'd be little bars and then it'd be like a fucking metal bar and then there'd be, you know. So it was.
But we're talking fun local bar bands, not like not big bands you hear, you know, not big bands coming into town to tour.
Some big bands, Midas the Bear came to town. There were a few bands that were huge. But the ones that I was filming were mostly local bands.
Which is actually kind of more rewarding, I would think, to like they get were to fun. Know the bands and
yeah, oh,
be
yeah.
a part of the
oh,
scene.
Yeah. My first...
And by the way, you say shoot, sorry, let me cut
oh, no,
you
no,
off.
You're fine, you're fine.
So were you like just shooting live shows for them so that they would have like something cool to...
I was filming their live shows, but I never gave them any footage.
So you didn't like cut something together for them to throw on a website or something?
That wasn't the thing back then.
Right.
It wasn't even the thing yet.
MySpace was the thing, wasn't it?
Like YouTube was new still, you know? Yeah. And so nobody really thought, and honestly too, I mean, you know, it was just too time consuming. I didn't, you know, I editing good, like subpar footage with terrible audio, you know, cause it will always be like, and then you'd hear the music and shit. And then literally I couldn't make out what the fuck anybody was saying ever, you know,
and you got the fucking
like
crowd noise. Yeah.
Then, but you would get, they'd get the crowds, you know? And so there was one band that I followed, that was like my favorite band. And I made a documentary out of them, called, Look at My Mustache, but it's like 50 minutes. I think it's on Vimeo, still, but I don't know. I got to make it more available. I know it's on my website, but I don't know exactly.
That's
where.
A fantastic name. Look at My Mustache.
That was one of their songs.
That's
and it was
great.
About Larry Zonka. And, they would always go out and say, this song is about Larry Zonka doing cocaine. And literally it was a punk band. All their songs were 30 seconds long. 30 seconds to a minute. It was the first time that I actually experienced sensory overload.
Right.
And that became very important from that point on in my life. And so now noise bands and things like that. Spoiler alert, Sound of Metal was my favorite movie of the last year. So
same.
One of the reasons because same. Of just that, you know, I was one of those people who were going to those shows, but filming, you know what I mean? And so like, and I remember that movie being announced in 2012 and being psyched about it and telling people about it and thinking it's a great idea. And then he made it and never released it. And then finally made it again. And I'm like, you know, what a crazy fucking story that is. You know?
I don't know the story behind it. I just know it was the best film of the year and almost nobody saw it.
When I talked
to people, everyone saw No Man's Land and this, that, and the other. And I'm like, did you see Sound of Metal? Don't say you've seen the best film of the year.
I would like to go on record to say that Nomadland was fucking garbage.
Okay, but that'll be for the next the next podcast where we do the four questions. We can.
But yeah, no, yeah. I just to preface that I was not a fan, and we'll talk. But yeah, you know, but no, Sound of Metal was, you know, because those were the guys.
Yeah, that was that world.
That was that world for me. Yeah, and then I started doing short films, and then you know, wasn't out here until I was like, oh man, we got to start.
And you were doing short films while going
to school
to Cape Fear, yep. and having yep. that great inspiring teacher, mm-hmm. and just everything. So everything was coming together.
Slowly but surely. 2010, 2011 was when I was living with a group of guys who literally, like, I'm trying to think of a way to make that into a movie. We had a great house. We were living on a lake. You know, we were shooting golf balls in the lake every fucking day. You know, just that was how it went, you know? And then, you know, next thing you know, after we throw a raucous party, the house gets, you know, red flagged. And then the landlord kicks us out. And then we ended up having to move because the place was getting condemned. So it was like the Fight Club house, you know?
Yeah,
we
lived in
the Fight Club house,
which is rad.
And that was like film school, and then film school as well was living with and a couple more places. But, you know, yeah, we had a crew, which are pretty much, you know, the same dudes that I'm working with now. And, you know.
Also, most of the most people of the you were hanging with there came to LA.
Here, yeah.
Are you want to say, when did you come out?
August,
like a couple years after that, or?
It was, we left late July and we got here August 1st, 2014.
Okay, so about, and we're talking 2010, 2012 right now.
Yeah.
Right, so you stuck it out a couple more years.
Mm-hmm. And then DSLRs had just come out.
Huge
pivot. And we were like, oh, this is a game changer. And so from 2012 to 2014, it was just make as much shit as we can while we're doing everything we can. I finally graduated with just my fucking 2-year degree after 4 years. That's how much shit I was doing. To be fair, I was an intern on One Tree Hill and I was doing a ton of shit. But like at the same time, looking back at it, you know, it was kind of like the most weirdest, interesting experience. Not a typical 4-year experience.
Well,
but,
I might
know.
Add that nobody is supposed to go to a community college and get a 2-year degree. Everyone's supposed to
right. The
learn
graduation
there.
Rates were
like,
really low.
Like, yeah, I mean, yeah, actually getting is it an associate's degree or
yeah,
whatever?
Yeah,
but
yeah,
getting
yeah.
that AA is like, that kid, just getting it proves
right.
something.
Well,
because most people are just there to like, I want to be able to do some accounting or something.
Yeah. Well, that's the only thing that I got. And then, you know, I had some family crises and then I got some money and I came out here. So.
Excellent. Was there a big conversation among you and your crew that like.
Yeah, we were all
were
kind
you guys
of,
always talking about LA or.
Yeah, but we, I had a family crisis and, one of my, closest friends had a family crisis. And so we both had a lot of money. We were just like, let's move. And we came here and, we spent a year trying to basically prep ourselves and prep everybody else. And so, and then eventually we just bounced.
And you hopped in cars and drove mm-hmm. for a month?
Yep. A couple days, about a week.
Oh, a week, okay.
Yeah, a week.
When you said the months, I thought it was like, wait, right. No, so
no,
it was,
yeah, yeah. Late July.
That could
like,
be a really fun. I was getting into the fact that, like, you know, you just take the 10 at that point
no,
or something,
dude,
right?
The,
like you drive it across the country can
the
be a great experience,
was,
too.
The drive was not fun. But
oh, that's
it
too
was
bad.
What it was. We were just trying to get out here, you know?
Right. You were and getting
then,
it done.
Yeah, yeah. And then we didn't know anything. And then one of our roommates left. And then, so then I lived in North Hollywood ever since.
Oh, did you land in North Hollywood? Was that the first spot you guys
That was
you
the
ended
second
up?
Spot.
Second spot.
That I ended up in. First spot was up in Sylmar.
Oh, sure.
Second spot was NoHo. And, right. And then that was it. It was pretty much, you know. And so I've been there ever since. Back, you know, I went to Van Nuys for a little bit, but came back. And so, yeah.
And did you start shooting stuff right away once you got out here, or?
I knew a buddy of mine. I knew a guy who was doing a bunch of, like, PA jobs. Things like that, working for, you know, just random shit. Basically what I'm doing
Which is
now.
What you have to do.
Everybody
does that.
Yeah, he had gone to film school already, and he had done all that shit, and he was already working, but he wasn't really working. He was just working with a friend of his, come to find out. But, like, that was it, then nothing, then I had to do my own thing, then nothing, then I had to do my own thing, then nothing, then I had to do my own thing, then nothing, then finally... you know, literally out of the gate, I was just like, okay, I have to work on my own shit now. Like, this is getting to the point where it's just like, you know, So I ended up basically I hooked up with a friend of mine who did a commercial, and that's how I met Doug.
So you met Doug doing a commercial?
Yeah, yeah. One of my closest buddies who I used to live with, he ended up working with Doug through the grapevine of like friends. And then I told Doug about a bunch of things, and then just trying to gauge his personality, really, you know, and he really liked what I had to offer, and we became Facebook friends. And then he
was right, Doug Birch. I'll throw in his last name.
Right? Yeah. Doug Birch. Yeah. And then he was doing his feature film, The Lost One. And I asked if I could work on it for free. And he was like, yeah, sure. And at the time I really was just like, who am I to ask for money? You know, and I was just like, I just moved here, but you know, I wanted to get my,
you're still new.
This is about
pre circles.
Oh, very much so. Okay. This is about maybe like a year and a half in. Maybe a year in, you know? And so then, you know, started doing stuff. And then I captured, like, his personality. And I was, like, thinking about him. And I was just like, man, this guy's done a lot of shit. And nobody really knows about it. Like, what's the deal, you know? So then I started
writing. Yeah, like the life of the character actor.
Right, yeah. And I didn't know any of these things at the time. You know, like, he was just, like, a dude who was like, oh, yeah, no, I work on these things. And I was like, what do you work on? And he's like, oh, I work on everything, like, under the sun, voiceovers and shit. And then I found him and I was like, oh, my God. I was like, this guy is interesting. And then so I started writing by hand what became Doug.
Many, many years ago.
This was 2015.
15. And I assume you shot the film in 2019?
2018.
2018. And then yeah. You had a year of post or so.
I was editing as we were still shooting.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah. I'm like so, totally. Like, I'm totally blanking on. Yeah, you know, you did the. You did what I think is a really. I almost wish that one day, like, you know, a big film would do the thing where you like shoot a couple days here and there for like a year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I think it creates a more interesting piece that you're able to adjust. You're able to adjust the screenplay as you're going to what you're getting. People are able to adjust their performances instead of cramming everything into like 2 weeks from hell and then hoping to edit something worthwhile out of it.
I mean, yeah, it really depends. Like now I'm finding like it depends on the project. I mean,
oh, it does.
Yeah.
I'm just saying
at that point I had nothing else going on. And so that's all I really wanted to obsess about. And so I was just, you know, when we were shooting, I was like trying to get the scenes that we shot done before we focused on other scenes. And usually they'd take me about a week, 2 weeks. At the same time, I would want to shoot again. So I would, you know, use that as my like, you know, inspiration to say, hey guys, let's keep going. Let's keep doing this, you know? And you know, everybody who was working on it knew that, you know, what I wanted to do. They just didn't really care because they were like, yeah, let's work. Let's actually get out there. Let's actually, you know, make stuff.
And you weren't asking them to give up 6 months of their lives. You were asking for a weekend here and there.
When it came time, I mean, I asked Doug for a year and a half of his life.
Yeah, so, that's true.
But
he was able to do other jobs throughout.
Oh,
right?
For sure. Yeah. But here's the crazy part, though.
Also, like, the movie's named after him. Might have been a little inspired.
Well, I know more about him now than I did when we were actually making it. I still don't, you know, it's one of those things where like, there's still.
Right.
Like,
it is a fictional character.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No. We had talked about it. I mean, it took me years to write it. At one point, I think during 2016 and 2017, I was writing a draft a month. And so literally it was literally like at the end of the day, I had 20 something drafts and a friend of mine was just like, I can't read anymore. I was just like, this is fucking done, man. He's like, you just have to own it. And he's like, whatever it is, you just have to own it. And I was like, okay. And so I thought
about
it.
And was Doug reading them and getting back? Or?
He read a few of them. He didn't read all of them. In some drafts, in the earlier drafts, he dies in every draft. And some other drafts, it wasn't until later that I realized that, you know, it should be he gets what he wants, but it's not really what he wants. And so, and that was kind of like just because I was watching people at my job, you know, with all this money, with all this shit in Studio City, thinking, oh man, these guys don't have enough, you know? And then, and you know, it wasn't until later that I would be like, oh, okay, now I see why. But at the same time though, they were just not real, you know, they were just like kind of like, you know, they're executives and shit, you know, they're people who like have real jobs, but like are money people and don't understand the art behind it. And so,
right. So you were actually exposed to those people through work.
Yeah. Yeah. And also to different shoots that I was on, you know, just observing and, different things and just trying to understand people.
You were kind of, but also seeing
a lot
of the unappealing sides of the.
Oh yeah, no. Well, a lot of the cafe scenes were inspired by real life situations that I had either seen or that I had either thought about, and I would literally be like walking to a table with somebody's latte, and I would hold on to their receipt, and I would just write down, you know, the little things that I was like thinking about. You know, maybe a scene of Doug talking to a guy,
right,
giving him his headshot, asking to be his agent. They laugh at him. And yeah, that was in the movie, you know, so little things like that.
Yeah,
the
microaggressions and put downs that, yes, you constantly hear.
And you know, what's funny is that
because it's a pissing match deep down. Yes. The whole industry is well, pissing match and or,
yeah,
you know, not to be overly masculine, but it's just like, you know, let me know my, you know, it's like dick competition.
Right.
It's like, who's
right
got a bigger dick?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
You know, every stupid conversation.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, a lot of it was just kind of like, let me try to capture as much of that as I can. And, you know, there were times when we were shooting that I was like, oh, this is fantastic. And times when I was editing it that I was like, oh, this is great. And then times when afterwards, after it was released, after all the work had been done, I was like, did I do enough? And I still don't. I still
do. Meaning do enough, like include enough?
Did I do enough? Like, did I do it justice enough? Did I, you know, did I, like, did I actually, like, that particular character in the instances that I did? Because there were a lot of stuff that we shot that I just could not include. I mean, I had to cut, like, 30 minutes out because, you know, of just what I was trying to include was either just too much or it was too redundant or it just didn't fit. And then, you know, recently, I'm just like, you know, like maybe a few months ago, I was like, why couldn't I edit better? You know, so like, I was like, why couldn't I actually think about, oh yeah, this when I was editing the fucking thing, you know? And like, so I don't really know though, but you know, looking back at it, I think that's what you learn, right? You know, and initially it was just kind of, get something out there on, in a feature film capacity, thinking that everybody was going that route, finding out, yes, people do go that route. However, you know, so, but yeah, you know, that was pretty much, that was that. And
let me ask the cinematography question, which is, of course, it looks really good. I mean, it is a great looking film. So the question is that natural? Did you build up these, your skills as a cinematographer, like from starting at the band, like,
oh yeah,
shooting,
oh,
bands, yeah, leading up to, because I, yeah, mean, it looks, I mean, was it in your mind, was it mostly black and white with some critically color scenes all along? Because your black and white looks perfect.
Oh, thank you.
And that,
thank
that's you. Not, a lot of people think you can just shoot with the DSLR and then desaturate it after the fact to look right, but it won't.
I actually, I wanted to do it in black and white because, all my favorite movies are in black and white, but also too, more importantly, because I was taking a black and white photography course, and it was with film back in like college and back at Cape Fear days. And it was with film, and that's where I fell in love with black and white. And
shooting on 35mm,
yeah,
still black and white,
yep,
or
35 yeah millimeter, still black and white. Yep. And I still shoot in 35mm, still black and white. It's a fucking expensive fucking process now, but I do it. But you know, I hadn't shot in about a couple of years, but I definitely want to go back. It just has that like uncanny presence to be sharper. It does more, but now I think I honestly do kind of trend both ways now. I'm thinking color is just as important now in so many different ways. But for me, for this project, it was always when he is in that euphoric state of mind, it should be in color. And when he's in the real world, it's black and white. Yeah. Because that's kind of, and you know, and I was running with that for the longest time, you know, this piece and this piece. And then everybody read it differently, you know, and was like, oh, okay, that makes sense. But,
yeah, you are expressing something that's internal.
A lot of it is anger. Yeah, there's a lot of anger in that movie. It doesn't come off.
The color stuff, actually, like the stuff on the beach, he's clearly pissed off.
But it's supposed to be cold, you know? And when we shot it, it was like springtime, you know, kind of nice. So I tried my hardest to, make it blue instead of making it gold, which was hard because I love gold for daytime. But, you know, the whole thing was really just kind of like, I kind of think of that as like my PhD, if it were my thesis, that would be it.
Right, that project would, right. Like if you're a professor back at Cape Fear said, and now shoot a feature to get as your thesis project, that kind of is what you did. Yeah.
I mean, you know, there were scenes that like I had to rethink that were in the earlier drafts that I wanted to include, like that were just, because a lot of the scenes that they were very kind of just like, the stereotypical cliche of let's do this because this is how I felt at a moment in time, blah, 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 you know. And then it really didn't hit me until later on that I was like, okay, maybe I should like kind of like bring it down and control the fire a little bit, you know. And then I started to kind of analyze it in a different way. So like at earlier drafts, there were really long acting class scenes. Mostly because I wanted to use certain locations and I couldn't get them, so I had to retailor them and I had to restructure them. And then there's all these little like tidbits that I threw in there that were just really like for me that I don't think anybody else, unless they actually read into it or think about it, would pick up on. Like the fact that Death of a Salesman was a big inspiration on it. Like the fact that the acting class scenes, they didn't really need to be big. All the bullshit that casting directors and that, people who are within that realm in the audition room, what they go through. So, you know, we had some fun, but it wasn't really like, at the end of the day, I was just like, is this enough? Is this not enough? Am I doing my job? Little things like that. There were things that I'm now writing into other scripts from earlier drafts because I liked it so much, but we couldn't keep it. So, you know, a lot of little things like that, you know. I think it came out well. I think it's, you know, I talk to people all the time who bring it up and they're like, oh, this is fantastic. And I'm like, really? You watched it? Cause no one's seen it. Nobody had, like, in truth, like how many times have you seen Goodfellas or Casino? Like you watch them when they're on, but when do you ever seek them out? You never seek them out.
No, so, especially in this new world of, streaming. Obviously keeps us from hitting our library now. Used to have a bookshelf with some people had a ton, some people had a few, but yeah, I'm old enough. We had some films on VHS, like I had Miller's Crossing on VHS, so I've seen Miller's Crossing a million times.
Yeah.
You know, because like most Saturday nights, you know, when you're young and you have roommates and you're like, what are we going to do tonight?
Oh, yeah, no, yeah,
let's
yeah.
pop that tape in again.
Yeah.
And now you got a billion things on Netflix, Amazon, and Hulu, and it's like there's no reason not to watch something you've never seen before every night.
Yeah, and my movie's too depressing, so.
That's interesting. Hey, I was going to say.
Well, to me, it's a comedy, but it's not really a comedy.
Well, when you were talking about did you do your job or not, yeah. And I was going to tell you, of course, you did.
Right.
But yeah. I was also going to say that it depends what you felt your job was. Like if you saw your job was to make this feature film about a character actor, a character study of a character actor who kind of loses his shit or is losing his shit, you did it.
I hope so.
If you felt you were doing a critique of the entire industry, like The Player, you know?
But
there's elements of that. Like, you definitely show.
I hope so.
Like, let's put it this way. The Player is about 0.001% of Hollywood.
Yes.
And your film is probably about 90% of the people who want to make it, right? Because every fucking for every actor we've heard of, there's, I can't even throw out a number for how many thousands there are.
Oh, no, yeah, for sure.
That might have been just as talented, too, that just, you know.
And, you know, that never really occurred to me.
No? While making it?
I was listening to a ton of podcasts and a ton of things, you know, and I was like, oh, man, this is like an every person thing. But it was like, getting that message from above saying, like, hey, this is it. This is it. Every day, something literally new happened when I was writing the project. And that even when we were doing it, I was like, fuck, can't use that. Can't, you know, there were moments where I was like, I want this to happen, but life and shit rolls itself out a different way. I can't think of anything specific, but there were so many notes that I had that I was just like, I have to scrap it. Because little tidbits that happened. Like, there were some shots, too, where, like, we did it and dug in real life. Because, like, the way we shot it, too, you know, I didn't fucking ask for fucking, I didn't get permits. Fuck that. The whole thing was 10 grand, you know, just about. And you know, we didn't have money for permits or any of that.
Yeah.
So Doug and I, you know, I'm like trying to figure out my geography of Hollywood and how it feels. And, you know, I was like, well, we need to shoot entirely on Hollywood Boulevard. And so, I just told him, I was like, listen, this is what's going to happen. Like, one day you and I are going to be walking. One day you're going to be walking. I'm going to be on skates. One day, you know, that was just how it went. And a lot of the shots where, you know, we used an amalgamation of all of them. I don't remember which days were which, but there were a lot of shots where I was on skates, skating on Hollywood Boulevard, keeping up with him.
Right. And you use skates so you could get that, like, dolly vibe.
Yeah. And there were a few shots
where... Or Steadicam vibe, whatever. Yeah.
And there were a few shots where I wanted to keep because they looked really cool. Even with the ricketiness, I really didn't mind. Because really, like, the whole thing was like, the show Louis was also a huge inspiration. So everything, you know, cinema verite was just like, you know, interesting to me. And it's still interesting to me. And so the fact that, like, I see it all the time, you know, and, like, cameras are just, you know, like, yeah, they're steady cam, sure. But a lot of people get hung up on that shit. And I think, really, having a little bit of, like, shakiness is not a bad thing, especially when you see it every fucking where. Even when they're adding it in post, it's still the thing. And I'm like, the reason why handheld is so nice and so natural is because there's literally a guy literally behind the camera saying, oh, fuck, 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 every time, literally trying to hold it and literally trying to hold it steady enough. You know, and it's just one of those things where it's like, you know, what I learned in by shooting the bands, just dance with them and it'll be fine.
Yeah.
You know,
and actually Steadicam can look great. Mm. And it was nifty as fuck when it first came out. And it was like, wow, you can, like, you know, do these Scorsese fucking oneers that
sure.
go.
Yeah.
But the truth is, there's an intimacy to handheld.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, not that everything should be handheld. But I, you know, I'm one of those people who, like, noticed, I forget when, but I noticed when the first person video games gave you the bounce of walking. And if you just walk down the street, you're like, your eyes are never actually steady.
Right.
Like,
right.
They're like Steadicam moving, is completely artificial. You cannot recreate, you cannot walk from an alley through a restaurant to a table without tons of jitter, tons of bounce. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah.
You know, Steadicam is actually sort of a slick, unrealistic presentation. Well,
you know why they made it, right?
Well,
Full Metal Jacket.
It was invented for Full Metal Jacket?
For the most part, yeah.
I did not know that.
Stanley Kubrick was getting pissed that they couldn't have tracks that were just never ending. So he
right.
had his
he,
camera
he wanted
guy,
dolly tracks for Miles.
So he had this camera guy literally just create this thing. And it was one of those dudes who was like working on like Apocalypse Now too or some shit. I really don't know the whole story per se, but you know, whatever. But anyway,
he challenged him to come up with a rigging where it would be attached to a dude's chest.
Yeah, and that was like one of the very first movies that was implemented in was Full Metal Jacket. And then ever since then, it was just like the carte blanche, let's do this, Kubrick method of, you know, getting things done. But like really though, I mean, you know, necessity is the mother of invention, right? Like You know, so with that in mind, we were just like, whatever happens, happens. Whatever we're capturing, we're capturing. There were a lot of moments on Hollywood Boulevard that were just like really wonderful moments that I thought were going to backfire, but didn't. You know,
the truth is there's not that many cops in this town, so you were pretty
safe. No, we were, and then they didn't care, man.
Yeah, if they saw you, they figured you were just like some people on vacation, you know?
Well, yeah, because they don't see, because like the way that, you know.
You
the
didn't
way
have like 15 people walking down the boulevard.
I mean, usually like, yeah, my sets are very small, and so I like them like that. If you're not there, you don't need to be there. Get the fuck out. Because it really is like a safe space. And now that, you know, everything is becoming more naturalistic, you know, my only hope is that things get cheaper and like to make anyway, so that, you know, you can get these A-listers who are, you know, working on these little or smaller projects that, you know, would otherwise remain nameless because they don't have anybody there. I mean, really, I think that any, like, one of the biggest sins in life is the fact that, you know, a person in show business made $1 million on a project anyway. You know what I mean?
Yeah, one of those that never saw the light of day, but they still got their paycheck, you mean?
No. Just anything in general.
Oh.
I don't think, I mean, honestly, you know, this is very socialist to me, but I don't think anybody should really, you know, make more than they actually should on an art project. Like, yes, like it's a several $1 million thing. I get it. You know, you're paid a quota, but at the same time though, why are we watching these Marvel movies that make, you know, that are like $100 million per movie with these enormous casts and these enormous things that happen? Yeah, I get it. But can we think smaller now? And, you know, for a minute I was like thinking, oh wow, COVID is actually going to make people think differently about how, you know, projects are made. Big projects are always going to be extravagant. That's what makes them really cool, you know? But like at the same time, what about these smaller projects? You know, like who the fuck has $100,000? You know, who the fuck has $20,000 to make something? I mean, literally some of this is like year salaries for most people, you know? And so, you know, that's why I don't believe in crowdfunding.
Yeah.
You know, it's because you're asking people who don't have money for your thing. Like, that doesn't really.
Yeah.
And sure, you know, there are these, you know, incentives, but in actuality, it's just heightened narcissism, you know?
It is. I'm with you. And, you know, I'll just add, when you were talking about, you mentioned, you know, socialism, this and that. I always, for years I've said, actually for about 30 years, I've said, you know, if being a super successful filmmaker, writer, director, whatever you want to call it,
mm-hmm.
got you a solid middle class lifestyle.
Yeah.
Then films would be so good.
Oh, of course.
Because you wouldn't have, because I've met hundreds of people who, like, you know, they start saying, I want the house, I want the cars, they want all this stuff. Like, they, if if the only reward of filmmaking was making a great film, and then you have kind of the same income as a high school teacher,
mm.
like, then films would be really fucking good because no one would be doing it for the wrong reasons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And now they're just terrible because too many people are doing them for the wrong reasons. It's one of the reasons why we don't have a budding art community in this country is because everything is too capitalist. I mean, we can go on.
Yeah, but like, we don't support the arts.
We don't support the arts at all. They were cutting shit when I was in fucking school. They're still cutting shit now. They'll never, never stop cutting because that's what they fucking do and they love doing it. They get off to it.
Yeah, actually, Sherman Oaks Film Festival, this year of 2021, a lot of the stuff from Europe, like, you know, small,
mm-hmm.
brilliant little shorts, and in the end crawl in the credits, it's like partially funded by, and like, they got some government money because the government's like, oh, whatever, a film about a gay couple.
Oh, they were always doing that. You know,
they support it.
When I was growing up, the most frustrating thing to figure out was knowing that, like, when Peter Jackson was working at Circuit City, he was getting most of his movies funded by the New Zealand Film Corporation. And I'm just like, whoa, wait a minute. They don't fucking do any of that shit here. And, like, some people, like, when I was in Wilmington, they were all like, all right, you gotta get Cape Fear's, you know, film commission. And, you know, it just would have gone down the wrong path. I mean, like, there's, you know.
Might have gotten free permits. That's it, right?
Well, even in that town, you don't need fucking permits. Like, in Wilmington, you don't need permits. And, you know, permits are just a fucking scam created by the industry to basically scam productions because they have a ton of money. They're going to make more money out of it. They say it boosts the economy, but I haven't seen a fucking dollar go into it yet. Have you? You know, there's all these goddamn fucking tents everywhere, you know? So it's literally like, it's just one of those things where I'm just like, that just seems like slightly fraud, but I'm just going to let y'all get away with it, you know? Because it's not my place to be like, you know, this and that. Like, I got better things to do with my time. You know what I mean?
If
I
you definitely can't fix the United States. So it's like...
Well, trust me, another conversation was if I ever wanted... If I didn't give a fuck about filmmaking, I'd probably be a lawyer and just sue the fuck out of everybody. And then, you know, maybe run for office and then hopefully win and then do everything and then resign after I've done everything I wanted to do. Because fuck them all. They don't fucking deserve anything. You know, a lot of my friends who served in the military said, why did I come back? You know, why did I come back? I mean, that's such a great question. And, you know, a lot of them are just kind of like struggling now. And it's really sad. I mean, really, it's just all fucked up. But, you know... And, you know, one of those things is, like, for me, you know, I think that, like, you know, right now we're at a very weird time in history, and hopefully it's getting easier. But, you know, if I knew then what I know now about distributing and the companies to go through, you know, I would have probably trusted the distribution process a little bit more with this movie, but... you know, I don't right. really
well, so
know.
With this movie, did you,
with Doug, yeah.
With Doug.
Yeah,
with
yeah.
Doug, did you, like, approach the, whatever they are, you know, Gravitas and this, that, and the other?
No.
Did you just go your own from the start?
I pretty much was like, yeah, I took it on myself to say, listen, like, you know, put it into festivals and then see what happens. That was always, like, the classic route, you know, put it into festivals.
And by the way, you submitted it to Filmvasion LA?
Yes.
Before COVID started.
Yes. Before
and then COVID actually hit our final deadline was March 15th. And I believe the shutdown was the following Monday.
Oh my God. That's so funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because yeah. I was still shooting another project by then. Yeah.
Yeah. Like the next Monday was literally the day everyone went to the supermarket and bought everything in sight. I still got tuna cans from that
Jesus
day.
Christ.
Yeah. No.
Yeah. So you released, so you hit the festival circuit.
Mm-hmm.
In the pandemic, so it was just a whole, did you...
Online everything.
Did you keep submitting after you knew it would be online? Or did you dial back?
Yeah, but now I'm just not interested in any more of submitting. I mean, like, I was going to submit to Sundance and Slam Dance this year, and I'm just, like, not really. Because the funny thing is that, like, I think the fervor is over for that project. And I haven't thought about it in a million years, it seems. And it's only been like a year. And,
but as well, so when did you, it's on, you know what? I forgot to say at the beginning of this podcast, I should have said you should watch Doug on Amazon Prime Video, right?
Well, no, it's not. Okay. So
is it?
So this is what happens with distribution that nobody really knows about until they do it is, you know, right now what I noticed was, during COVID was that all of the conglomerate corporate companies that we can think of off the top of our hands were basically freaking out because movie theaters were dying. And so what they all did was put a plus sign by their name and they included streaming platforms, which opened up the floodgates for their productions, which is fine. But what it does for independent filmmakers is basically fucks them over because now the algorithm includes a ton of other things that would have included our things. But at the same time, you can keep it on Amazon Prime. You can keep it on those platforms. In fact, you can go through aggregators to get it onto those platforms. It just can't be released. It just can't be talked about. Like a whole lot, like no clips released until that's released kind of thing. You could put a trailer, I guess, online, but you can't really do much of anything else until like these guys are like done with their things that they do. And so I just didn't have that time. I was just like, this is fucking ridiculous, you know, because the movie's done. It already got the award at the awards at Film Invasion. And so I was just like, okay, well, now I know it's good enough to stand on its own. You know, we got rejected from a few others, but then I was just like, ah, fuck it. Then other festivals accepted us immediately because of Film Invasion. So, you know, it was a bit of a yin and yang thing, up and down thing. And then Amazon Prime took it off of Amazon Prime. So
it was up there for a bit. And then did they do that thing where they said, you can't be free anymore?
Yeah.
You can't be included.
You can't be included in Prime anymore, but it could still be up there.
But you can charge $3.99 or whatever.
Which I think, you know,
which
honestly,
is fair.
Well, I think it's a win because when it was free, we had more views than when it wasn't free.
Yes.
And so that was the crazy thing to me was
and
that
you got like, you know,
Prime.
You could have like 1,000 hours viewed in a month and they'd send you like 11 cents.
Yeah, exactly. I think I got maybe $20, maybe $50 from Amazon because of that.
Yeah.
But here's the crazy thing, though, is that it's not about any of that shit. It's not about the money. It's not about any of that fucking bullshit. At the end of the day, you know, I had to write, direct, produce, edit, shoot, cast, worry, you know, all that shit. Just for that project, just for Doug, you know, and now it's on Amazon Prime and it's also on Vimeo On Demand, both of which you can get through my website, which we'll talk about later. But overall, though, it had the biggest win for me that is if you look up Doug 2020 and or my name, it'll pop up. So it has an online footprint, you know, so it's fine.
And that's like just in a search field.
Right.
Yeah. Which is good.
And for the small amount of ratings that it has, I mean, I'm pretty grateful for that, you know. And to think that the movie is titled after a fucking TV show that was made in the 90s. Give me a break.
Oh, the animated thing?
Yeah, yeah.
That would never occur to me.
Well, that's the crazy thing is that when you pop up Doug on Amazon, a lot of it comes up the TV series.
Right, that's where you got
to
have the 2020.
And I never thought about that. And so I was just like, oh, you motherfuckers. So literally, so right. I have
you
to specify.
You should have had the birch on there.
Well, I had to specify 2020. And, you know, it's just like, it's titles, man. Titles are weird, you know. So like, but if anybody really is interested to seek it out, that is where, you know, you can find it, you know. You could find it through the IMDb page. You could find it through, like, there's channels, there's ways to see it. But it's only on two things right now, unless somebody decides to do something with it.
And, I mean, I know this is blowing smoke at a certain level. But, like, if the acting community, you know, like there's acting teachers that should be able to tell their class, by the way, like, you should watch Doug sometime. You should watch this film about this character actor, because you know, if you think you're going to turn into, you know, if you think you're going to be the next Brad Pitt, you should ask yourself, will you be the next Doug Birch? You know what I mean?
Or just Doug Bridgers, but
if you come to this town to be an actor, or you're consider yourself a struggling actor, like
of course,
like I feel like. Your film does a lot of justice.
Oh, thank you.
That actors, that budding actors or whatever term, I don't want to say struggling, but, you know, just actors in general, aspirational actors would probably appreciate the shit out of that film.
I hope so. Yeah. Well, that was the crazy thing too, was that, you know, I didn't expect people to say, oh, I know people like that. Like, I know a lot of people like that and they quit and they did this or that. I did not expect that to be a thing.
Because, oh, dude, first 5 minutes, that's what I was thinking.
Oh,
I was
really?
Thinking of all the actors I know who are
Oh, wow. No, because literally, like, I, you know, I mean, and maybe this is where I should get flack on, because, like, to me, you know, it was more of a catharsis of Los Angeles, and then it grew into this character. That's always what it was. And then I never thought about the between the lines aspects of, oh yeah, like, you know, this is what people go, like, it's not easy, you know, and like a lot of people do either die or end up in, you know, cause you know those stories, but you don't really know those stories. And so like, you know, the fact that like in real life, like, you know, Doug, he actually is a voiceover actor and that's how he makes money. And, you know, he lives in a great house. I mean, I just got off, I've been off, you know, several disappointing shoots because people who are filming those shoots think that, you know, they want to make like the reason why they're doing this is so they can get millions of dollars. And I'm like, that's not how it works.
Like indie shoots where they, where they're full of that.
I was on one that I was shooting this past year. That was a fucking nightmare.
Right. And, so you were the DP and whoever was behind it was
and
like,
and they expected me to do every other role. And it was just a goddamn nightmare. And, you know, I pretty much disowned it because, you know, I really don't care. Guy has yet to do anything. You know, I've not, you know, been on anything quite like that where I've been insulted and I never actually get the whole, you know, and it's really not about any
of that.
You
weren't even given what you were promised, you mean?
I wasn't even given a base camp. We were told, like, I was literally on a fucking terrible, like, this was like, you know, Doug actually had production value compared to this piece of shit thing. This piece of shit thing was just blessed to have good actors. So, you know, but like I do shit for money where I film stuff for money. You know, I like film other projects and things like that. And like a lot of people just don't, you know, they see the dollar signs at the end of the road. They don't understand the production aspect. So, you know, when I talk so highly about my Cape Fear times, you know, and I get emotional because it's like David Kreutzer and Lucinda McNamara were my two mentors. They were the true people who said, this industry is terrible. You do it because you love it. And that's the bottom fucking line. You know, we weren't watching The Graduate because it was a good movie. We were watching it because that's art. We were watching it because of, like, you know, and at one point, like, one of the papers that I wrote was just too much on about lighting. And he's like, it's art, not science. And I'm like, but Ampass. And he's like, yeah, but what does it say? And before sciences, arts. You know what I mean? So I was like, okay, fine, you win. But, you know, it is a little bit of all that. And unless you actually work on stuff, you
don't
really understand
it. It is art and science. It's definitely a balance.
I think it's, yeah, I don't really know how to quantify it. I mean, Salvador Dali once said, like, the most, you know, it's probably the most influential medium. And he was absolutely right. And it was one of those crazy things where, like, you know, when you watch Unchi and Nanalu, you think, oh, man, these guys were fucked up. But, like, you know, now it's like, you know, you can get into John Waters territory. And then the later Shock Value stuff of even now is just even out of control. So I don't really know. I think it has a lot to do with just, you know, where we are at different epochs. And I think that is important. Understanding that is important. That's what film theory is supposed to teach, and it doesn't. And, you know, that's infuriating because a lot of people don't, you know, it's more of a philosophy than a way of actually living, I feel like. And unless you actually adopt that as a point of view, then you're going to be completely lost. And then you're going to hate it. And then you're going to make a movie. You're going to spend way too much money on it that you shouldn't have spent on it, you know? And so, I mean, it's been a 12-year journey to make one movie.
Yeah.
Pretty much. So, yeah.
One feature. Yeah. You've obviously done a handful of shorts here and there, but
yeah. And now I'm like doing more, low budget features. Cause, you know, why not? Now is the time to get them out there and to fail. I mean, I should have done them back in like 2011, 2012. If I had done it back then when DSLRs were a thing, we probably wouldn't be having this conversation. Like, literally, because like just the way that everything kind of works within, you know, the 4-year generational gaps or the 6-year generational gaps, it's like insane. Like in 2011, 2015 or whatever, you know, Greta Gerwig, the Duplass brothers, you know, those were the cats who were lucky enough just to have the foresight to think, oh yeah, you know, we should do these terrible movies now. And not to say that every movie of that, I mean, I think it gets a bad rap. I think it should be called something else. I think I honestly do think that there should be an award category at the Oscars for guerrilla filmmaking, just for the simple fact that independent movies are more important than the bullshit that they're churning out now. And I think that, you know, although some people get very lucky with, you know, their bullshit, our bullshit still has yet to see the light of day. So yeah, it's one of those things where it's just show some love, you know, as my favorite Entourage quote, you know, show some respect for the below the line and watch the credits, you know, because it's true. You know, nobody gives a fuck. Everybody's just like, you know, and it's just sad, you know?
Yeah, so, even the Independent Spirit Awards, which I was aware of or actually voting for. Like, but when it was still IFP, Independent Feature Project, they, you know, the first couple of years it was truly indie. And now it's just another starfucker event.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's just, you know, it's just like who's got the... I think they have a micro-budget category that maybe... So maybe like five truly indie films get acknowledged a year. But you look at the list of films nominated, you know?
The shorts category?
I don't know.
No.
I
mean, you know...
It's become so relevant, actually. Well,
sure.
I don't really pay attention to it anymore. Every once in a while I see the list of the nominees and I'm like, you know, it's not an indie film if it's got...
Right.
You know, an actor who took a $250,000.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Who normally gets $10 million, but they took a, you know, they took $250,000 because they're helping the arts.
Yeah.
But I mean,
there was a movie where such and such, some dude, some buddy guy was in a movie about a buddy guy, and he ended up taking, I think it was 75% of the budget. You know, not going to say who it was, but. The movie still has not been finished because of that buddy guy.
Someone, this is a project you worked on?
No, this is a project that I heard through the grapevine through another buddy guy who told me about this buddy guy who had this guy fuck him over completely.
Oh, that's a hard story.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it's one of those things where, like, you know, I mean, I think that one of the things that I'd like to do in life, if I ever get the opportunity to, and if somebody is hearing this, let's go in on it. Cause I think this would be very important. You open up a little wine bar bodega that is a, pretty much a museum. And it's also a, filmmaking, and comedy and everything platform. You make it specifically for the arts and you call it the Museum of Laughter. And all it is just, you know, it's a wine bar. Yes. But it's also a museum. And for, you know, a little while, you get comedians and people who have infectious laughs. And then you get to hear them played back for you when you get to their, like, little thing. And it's just their laughter. So it's like, you know, people like that I find infectious laughter. But also, too, but like that's one side of it. And the other side of it is on certain nights they have comedy shows. On certain nights they have film nights. On certain nights they have, you know, things like that where it's like bands playing or screenings or things like that where it gets people into the place. But at the same time, it's really promoting every aspect of independent art that you can think of. Aside from the laughter of people, it's really just more so an art throw up event where basically, like, you know, it's almost like a commune of sorts, but disguised as a wine bar.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, I get where you're going because, yeah. Look, I have the same thoughts because programming a film festival that's local, like,
right.
You know, some film festivals do involve an art gallery too and some live music and some comedy, all kinds of stuff. Mm-hmm. And make it like a cultural arts thing, but you can't even come close to making ends meet if you don't sell booze.
Yeah.
Like making it part of a wine bar makes the artsy side possible.
Yeah, it would be something that could exist in Wilmington easily, but I don't know if it would exist in a big city like LA. It could, but you know, people have to be into it.
You need benefactors off the top so that you could survive.
Yeah, no, it would never really. It would be more like a pop up thing. I could see it, you know. But at the same time, though, like, you know, that's always been an idea, and one of these days maybe. But you know, because the reason why I say that is because there was a dude in Wilmington who used to live in this second floor apartment, you know, in my college town. And one day a date took me there and she was like, oh, yeah, no, this would be a cool spot. You'd love it. And this guy, it was like invite only based on who he knew, but he was a part of SAC and I didn't know that. And he was a voiceover actor. I didn't know that. And he would get these screeners of the award contenders and he would host movie nights where he would just show the screeners to a select group of people who actually showed up between the hours of 7 to 7:30. And it wasn't really anything he would advertise. It was just like, yo, I'm doing this, you know, if anybody wants to come by.
And friends of friends.
And then you walk into his fucking apartment and forget it. It was like one of those Warhol-style lofts where, like, you know, Velvet Underground is playing in one corner and a movie's playing in another corner. You know, it was literally just like that, you know. But yeah, no, that was a great time. And something like that, I think, is really important because, you know, all of the, like, the best experience I ever had for Doug was seeing it on a big screen. And then, you know, that's probably the only time we'll see it on a big screen for quite a while.
Yeah, because mostly because of COVID, right?
I mean, mostly because of COVID.
If COVID hadn't come along.
My plan was to get, was to literally get a DCP going for Doug at one point and then literally just whore it out to local theater companies who wanted to actually show movies. But it would only be for a weekend, and I would say, oh, it's going to be here, it's going to be here, it's going to be here.
Yeah.
And it would only be for like a few days. And then, you know, of course, the famous Tommy Wiseau thing where it's like he spent $1 million just doing that entirely. And so, you know, you would almost have to do it in places like the Arts District or like, you know, certain spots. I mean, you know, get lucky enough to screen it in real life at like Sherman Oaks or like Film Invasion, you know. But like at the same time, though, nobody could have ever predicted the last year to be a thing. So,
year and a half.
We're still really. I mean, but at least theaters are
open. We can go back in the theaters now. Yeah. So. I mean, as far as I know, in November, there's going to be a Sherman Oaks Film Festival only in the theater.
Fingers crossed. The only thing
that could stop it is another variant that completely makes the vaccine irrelevant. And then they'll close theaters. But right now, I don't even think. But I think we're actually going to have to require vaccination cards at the door, which is fine with me, actually.
Yeah, I don't really care. I mean, you know, it is what it is, man. I once, you know, my girlfriend and I went to go see Pig a couple weeks ago, and, you know, that theater was packed. Nobody really, you know, everybody was wearing masks, but, you know, I was, of course, like, you know, popcorn and shit. Like, I fucking go all out when I go to a goddamn theater. You know, I fucking go all out. I cannot wait to see the new James Bond movie. I'm gonna see it twice. Can't wait. You know?
I haven't done a theater yet, but I've done outdoor concerts. Like.
Yeah, yeah.
I went to a Dodger game.
But that's still outside.
Yeah,
that's
yeah, it's fine. Outside and
you
it's,
know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing is that, like, you know, we have to. It's this whole thing of adapting that we've never really done before. Have you seen Spike Lee's new thing, the documentary?
No.
You need to watch that. Everybody needs to watch that. It's probably the most important.
Is it on Netflix?
It's on HBO.
Oh, HBO.
HBO Max. New York City Epicenters. It's fascinating.
I love when he does it. I mean, I actually am a fan of all he does. But,
yeah,
but his I mean, a lot of people don't. He got his degree in documentary.
Oh, did he really?
I think his NYU emphasis was documentary.
Well, I remember seeing When the Levees Break, and I remember seeing this thing, you know, was just had like a similar impact. But, you know, it was funny though, because, yeah, he's always been one of those enigmatic figures to me who can like have the success that he has, not really give a fuck about what anyone thinks about him, and then kind of just put out, you know, a stunning, like, Scorsese-level documentary. And God loves Scorsese, but not all of his documentaries are great. A lot of them are fucking boring. I cannot get through the George Harrison one. But, you know, the Spike Lee joints are really fun. And I think, too, the Epicenter one, because he talks about how the response and the, you know, information from COVID-19 was no different than the response and information for 9/11. And he does the compare and contrast to both of those time periods. And, you know, just how New York gets destroyed every decade or so, every 10 or 20 years is just kind of, it's interesting to me because I used to love that town. I used to want to live in that town and now I don't ever want to go near it. But I would, you know, I still want to visit and stuff like that. You know, I asked myself if I had the opportunity to do it, to live in Greenwich, would I? Fuck yeah, for about a year. You know, but I've never people say they hate LA. I mean, that's kind of how I feel about New York. Sorry to say, but I've never really been, you know, the times that I've been was only a few times. And I was like, just kind of like, I don't know, man, you know, it's too fucking cold. So
New York is, I think
I love it though. It's a great city. I want to shoot there, but you know, it's one of those things where like, I don't know what the fuck's going on.
I can't remember the song, but it's something along the lines of, oh, it's a LCD Sound System song, but it's something about New York's great if you've got someone to pay the rent. Because it makes LA seem affordable, you know?
That's ironic. My family's lived in Staten Island for their entire lives.
Oh, yeah. So you have a home base there of sorts.
Yeah, sort of. I mean, you know, they do their own thing, but, you know, they're still family. And we talk all the time as much as we can. But, you know, they've been living the dream and doing what they want to do. And, you know, COVID hasn't stopped them at all. So I, you know, who knows? It's just so ridiculous. The whole thing is just out of control.
It's been tough.
And, you know, honestly too, I mean, we got so much, like, we're such a divide, like, as a country. Like, I remember when, like, Brokeback Mountain came out, and living in South Florida at the time, nobody could really accept it. You know, there's just like, our country is too big where to the point where there are pockets that don't get mainstream hookups, you know?
Yeah, but culturally, yeah, there are.
There's just too much going on.
I mean, everything might be, I don't want to focus on red and blue, but like everything might be purple, but the purple gets bluer and redder as you move around. And yeah, there's some places where.
Well, let's put it this way. When you talk to a foreigner, you know, I've talked to a bunch of them. I talked to this one French guy. He goes, oh, we know in France is New York and L.A. That's it. Well, what about Chicago? Oh, yes, that too. And it's like, what about Missouri? Oh, what? You know, and it's like, oh, see, you guys don't know what the fuck. So, yeah, but literally the big cities is what most people think about. And, you know, yeah, that's where we're at. It's just crazy to me.
It is interesting.
It's just bizarre.
It's tough. It's tough to think that Brokeback would be tame if it was released now.
Right, exactly. But there's still
parts of the country where they're like, I wouldn't want anyone to see that because it'll corrupt them.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Or even like more recently, too, you know, movies like Sorry to Bother You or like, you know, the ones that actually push the buttons on a very avant-garde level. People just
Call Me by Your Name.
Yeah, right, that, yeah. Well, you know, some of those movies, you know, yeah, I mean.
But, like, they do, you know, they do great in the.
You know what's crazy? Well, you know what's crazy about North Carolina is that when Drive came out, only one theater was playing it.
Really?
Drive with Ryan Gosling.
Yeah, Nicholas Winding Refn. Why? Yeah. Was that?
And it wasn't even the big theater. Can you believe that shit? I had to go at 2 in the afternoon. I had to skip
class.
Why
was it embraced as, like, a big, because it was, like, a little indie-ish?
Because nobody knows what the fuck's happening over there.
Really?
Nobody knows. And literally, like, I'm hearing like a teacher down the hall.
So it wasn't a superhero, so it was, like, hard to find.
Right, right. You know, I was listening to a teacher down the hall. He goes, oh, did you ever see this movie called Drive? And I turn around and go, yes, this guy gets it. Because, dude, that movie, I mean, yeah, that was a fantastic movie. And the fact that, you know, I could see it in this little box, like, nobody ever went to. It was me and two other people, you know? And we had the same questions. What the fuck is going on? Why is he killing that guy? Is he dead? You know, we were just like, what the fuck is this? You know? And it was such a, you know, yeah. But, you know, it's, yeah, yeah, that's about it. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, actually, to be honest, we should probably wrap it up and then jump into your four questions, because I think you're going to have a fun.
Yeah,
let's do it. It's going to be a fun four questions. So tell the people, those who are with us, and we thank you for being here.
No, thank you for having me, man. I really appreciate it.
What's the website? Where should people go if they want to pick between Vimeo or Prime? Or
My website is, you know, JonathanLatona.com, my full name, at Johnny Boy Films. But you can find all the extensions through my website, so just go there.
Excellent. And
Which I'm sure will be a link on the thing.
And so. God bless you for having a unique name, man.
Is it? I hope so.
Well, if you got JonathanLatona.com, that's pretty nice. Because needless to say, I couldn't get JeffHoward.com.
Right.
I don't know who has it. Some dude. Not even the more famous one.
The guy that I'm talking to right now.
The guy, I'm actually JeffHoward.me. if anyone cares. But I was able to get the .me like I live in Montenegro.
There you go. Yeah.
All right. Well, you know how to find Jonathan. So now I'm going to go ahead and give you the final spiel, which is if you're listening to this podcast, give it 5 stars, right? You're probably listening on on some podcast app, whatever. Just give it 5 stars. Actually, go on to Amazon Prime Video or go to Amazon.com and look up Doug 2020. And
don't go to Amazon.
Don't go to Amazon. I'm just saying give you stars. Give you stars.
Yeah. We'll go to IMDb. Rate it on IMDb.
Give them 10 stars. Give them a 10 out of 10. Oh, no. On Amazon, it's 5 stars. Right?
Just rate it on IMDb. Give it a 10 out of 10 on IMDb. Give it 5 out of 5 on Amazon and go buy it. Actually, buy it on Vimeo because that's where you know, you actually do support
it on Vimeo
and
watch it. It's a really, I tell you, it's a good film. You can watch it and then you can. And then you can go on Instagram and go to @JohnnyBoyFilms and have a conversation with the filmmaker.
Yes,
come on.
Yes.
And he'll pull Doug in.
Yeah, absolutely. No. I mean, I'm working on more stuff with him, actually.
Excellent. All right. Well, anyway, so, if you want to learn about Discover Indie Film, which is the podcast you're listening to, and there is a Amazon Prime Video companion TV series to it that's an anthology of great short films, go to discoverindiefilm.com, and on social media, it's @DIFWINS. And we talked about a couple festivals that Jonathan was at. Every November is the Sherman Oaks Film Festival, and you can learn about it at shermanoaksff.com. And on social media, it's @ShermanOaksFF. And finally, Film Invasion LA, where Doug cleaned up and took home 3 awards. Go to filminvasionla.com. And it's @FilmInvasionLA on social media. And that festival is every June. So we got one in June and one in November. Mm-hmm. And thanks, Jonathan, for coming in.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
And thank you, everyone, for listening. The next podcast after this one will be Jonathan answering the 4 questions.
Woohoo!
Which, favorite films, underrated, overrated, something to find. All right. We'll talk to you soon.